Welcome to the Age of Napoleon. Dispatch 5. As always, I'd like to start by thanking you for your support. I couldn't do this without you. I'd also like to thank those of you who have been submitting questions. When I started doing this, I worried I might not get enough good ones to make it a regular feature, but I've been really impressed with the quality and volume of questions. Most of the ones I have skipped have been because of time constraints, or because they're actually too good and I can't do them justice in a short format. So keep them coming. Not only do they provide material for these dispatches, I find it encouraging to see how many people are engaging with the show in a thoughtful way. Anyway, without further ado, on to the questions. Daniel Goldstein asked, "For the sake of historical context, what sorts of global technological advancements and inventions were being developed by or utilized in the new French Empire? Do you believe any were of particular consequence in Napoleon's conquests and governance?" A few things come to mind. First, the hot air balloon. This was a brand new technology at the outbreak of the French Revolution, invented in 1783. It was more used by the revolutionary governments before Napoleon, mostly by the military, as an observation post during battles. I don't think it had anything more than a very marginal impact in the few engagements in which it was used. However, the balloon became a symbol of the Republican government, and was often featured in revolutionary propaganda. As you might remember from past episodes, the revolutionaries saw their movement as representing the birth of a new age of progress and reason. Embracing new technology was a part of that image. As a recent invention that was already being adapted for military uses, the hot air balloon fit right into that image. I also think there's a bit of poetic resonance, the balloon rising skyward, taking human beings higher than they had ever gone before, granting them a unique and wider-ranging perspective of the world on the ground than they had ever known. The balloon was the perfect symbol for the revolution, even if it turned out to have extremely limited applications on the battlefield. There was also the optical telegraph, invented in 1792. This was a series of towers a few miles or kilometers apart, depending on visibility. Each tower was equipped with a semaphore system, which its operator would use to pass messages up and down the line of towers, thus relaying information across long distances in a very short time. The optical telegraph was very primitive compared to modern communications methods, but this system was capable of getting a short message from Paris to Lille in under 10 minutes, a distance of about 230 kilometers or 140 miles, which is quite good when the alternative is relay riders on horseback. Napoleon was a big believer in the optical telegraph. By the end of his reign, there were lines reaching every corner of France and into the Rhineland and modern-day Belgium. It had limited utility. Obviously, it was not suitable for secret information because anyone nearby could see it and try to crack the code for themselves. It could be hampered by bad weather, and there was the possibility of human error garbling the messages. But Napoleon's government made good use of it, and it would be copied in other countries until it was supplanted by the electric telegraph. Another new technology that comes to mind is smallpox inoculation. Contrary to popular belief, by the dawn of the 19th century, this was actually a very old practice. It had been used in Asia and Africa for centuries. Europeans and white colonists in the Americas were simply the last people to adopt it. However, the process was quite dangerous. As many as 20% of people who underwent smallpox inoculation died, although that was still much better odds than one would get from catching the disease in the wild. It wasn't until the late 1790s that a British scientist named Edward Jenner developed a safe method of inoculation, using a mild, related disease called cowpox rather than live smallpox virus. Jenner's discoveries were quite controversial and rejected by many. However, Napoleon was a believer. In fact, he greatly admired Jenner, calling him, quote, "one of the greatest benefactors of mankind," end quote. Jenner was well aware that Bonaparte held him in such high esteem. When he found out two of his friends were being interned in France as enemy aliens, he wrote a letter to Paris, begging for their release. Supposedly, when the letter reached Napoleon, he responded, quote, "Ah, Jenner, I can refuse him nothing," end quote, and acceded to the petition. All of the soldiers of the Grande Armée were inoculated, and Napoleon ordered civilian public inoculation campaigns all over his empire. We've talked in several episodes about the benefits of French rule. It would be impossible to calculate how many lives were saved by these measures, possibly millions. However, as I mentioned, inoculation was controversial. A lot of people opposed it. Some more colorful opponents of inoculation believed it was the mark of the beast, referred to in the Book of Revelations. In some places, this anti-inoculation sentiment was actually a major part of the opposition to French rule. I'll refrain from making any points about contemporary politics, other than to say it is sometimes surprising how much the present echoes the past. If you want to read more about inoculation in the Napoleonic era, there's a great recent article by Alexander Grob. People are often surprised by how little military technology changed during the course of the Napoleonic Wars. We often think of war as a time of great military innovation, when countries pour huge resources into research and development, and are eager to get new inventions into the field as quickly as possible. However, the weapons used by the French army at Waterloo were essentially the same as the models that Napoleon had trained with as a young cadet. He oversaw a slight modification of the standard infantry musket in 1800, and the artillery system was slightly altered in 1803, but if you took a French soldier from the American War of Independence and put him in the French camp on the eve of Waterloo, he would have immediately recognized the army's weapons, and would have had little trouble familiarizing himself with the new models in time to fight in the next day's battle. I think the title for most technologically advanced weaponry of this period probably goes to the British. We already discussed the naval inventions of Robert Fulton, which were employed by the Royal Navy. They also made the most extensive use of rifled firearms of any of the great powers, although it is worth mentioning that rifling was not really a new technology, it had been known for centuries. The trouble was creating a rifle that was practical for battlefield use and could be manufactured at the cost and scale required to be issued in thousands. Many rival powers felt the rifle was not worth the added cost and logistical complications, which the British could bear more easily. The British also made use of rockets, as you may know from the American National Anthem. Although these were also not really a new technology, but a refinement of a type of weapon developed in India. However, in my opinion, the most important military inventions of this period had nothing to do with weaponry. The French, and to a lesser extent the Russians, made great advances in military medicine. Probably most famously, the concept of triage was invented by the great French army doctor Dominique Jean Larrey. I've actually been thinking of devoting an entire episode to this topic. Early in his reign, Napoleon offered a prize of 12,000 francs to anyone who could invent a reliable method of food preservation. In response to this challenge, in 1804, just outside Paris, a chef and former revolutionary named Nicolas Appert invented a process he called canning. Obviously, this had huge implications for military logistics, which is why Napoleon had been willing to offer this generous reward. Ironically, despite collecting the award, Appert was a very poor businessman and soon went broke. There were a whole host of new scientific and industrial technologies in this period. Small railways were beginning to appear in Britain, although they were mostly horse-drawn. The power loom, the sewing machine, the cotton gin, the hydraulic press, the electric battery, the steam locomotive, and the internal combustion engine were all invented during or immediately before the Napoleonic era. But at this stage in history, all these technologies were in their infancy, and few predicted just how much this type of mechanical ingenuity would shape the next era of human history. However, in both the military and in broader society, most of the really exciting innovations did not come in the form of mechanical inventions. As we've discussed in many past episodes, this was a golden age for what we today would call social technology. New methods of administration and organization, more sophisticated financial systems, new doctrines, and new ways of seeing the world. The whole story of the revolution and its aftermath is, in many ways, the story of the consequences of all these new social technologies. In fact, without these social technologies being propagated across the world in this period, the massive technological changes of the 19th century would not have been possible. Next, Evan Skell asked, Armando Iannucci is known for making films such as The Death of Stalin and In the Loop, and TV shows like Veep and The Thick of It, where he shows the office politics of real politics to darkly comic effect. Is there an event during the Napoleonic story that you think would make a great Death of Stalin-esque film, or a period of time with a cast of characters that would make a good Veep-style show? As dark as it is, I could imagine the execution of the Duke of Enghien being mined for great comedic effect, or a show featuring the jockeying of the marshals for glory and attention. I'm a huge fan of Armando Iannucci. The Thick of It never aired in America, but when In the Loop came out here, I liked it so much I went to see it twice. The Death of Stalin is one of my favorite movies. I hope he does more historical fiction in the future. With that film, I think he did a really good job portraying the strange combination of high tension and total absurdity that sometimes accompanies momentous historical events. I like both of your suggestions. The murder of the Duke and the rivalries of the marshals would be a lot of fun. But when I first saw The Death of Stalin, the event that popped into my head was the coup of 18 Brumaire. The coup has plenty of drama. Soldiers in the streets, Paris locked down, dramatic speeches by impassioned politicians, conspiracies within conspiracies, with the fate of the country and the future of the revolution hanging in the balance. But there's also a lot of comedy built into the story. Those goofy Roman-style uniforms worn by the legislators, which apparently sometimes tripped them up as they tried to move. Napoleon acting tough, and then getting knocked out by a politician, then having to be saved by his little brother. Talleyrand barging in on Barras while he was taking his morning bath to secure his loyalty for the coup. Sieyès taking horseback lessons so he could act as a figurative man on the horse. And Murat's troopers combing the grounds of the palace, looking for toga-clad legislators trying to hide in the bushes. I think a mind like Iannucci's could go wild with these types of details. If any of you know him, play this segment for him. Next, Jonah and Sarah asked, I'm not sure if you've ever read War and Peace, though if not, I can highly recommend it. But in it, Tolstoy advances a very polemical view of history, and Napoleon in particular, namely that generals and, quote, great men, close quote, only appeared to direct events or armies, that instead moved under their own diffuse and decentralized power, like a flock of magpies. I'm curious what you think of Tolstoy's quite biased view of history in general, and Napoleon as a, quote, puppeteer whose strings were not connected to anything, close quote. How much control did he have over the Grande Armée, and how did command and control work in practice? To what extent do you agree or disagree that events like battles or even campaigns unfold under their own force, and are stamped post hoc with approval and the illusion of having been directed from the top? This is slightly embarrassing to admit, but I've never actually read War and Peace. I've seen a couple film adaptations, so I do know the story, and I've read essays on Tolstoy's depictions of Napoleon, so I do have some handle on that element of the book. But I've never sat down and actually read the whole thing. The idea of spending my free time working through a giant tome set during the Napoleonic Wars, when I spend most of my work days reading about the Napoleonic Wars, is somewhat daunting. For those of you who are not familiar with Tolstoy, here are a couple quotations from him on this theme that stuck with me. Quote, in giving and accepting battle at Borodino, Kutuzov acted involuntarily and irrationally. But later on, to fit what had occurred, the historians provided cunningly devised evidence of the foresight and genius of the generals, who, of all the blind tools of history, were the most enslaved and involuntary. The ancients have left us with model heroic poems in which the heroes furnish the whole interest of the story, and we are still unable to accustom ourselves to the fact that for our epoch, histories of that kind are meaningless. End quote. And another one, quote, the actions of Napoleon and Alexander, on whose words the event seemed to hang, were as little voluntary as the actions of any soldier who was drawn into the campaign by lot or by conscription. This could not be otherwise, for in order that the will of Napoleon and Alexander could be carried out, the concurrence of innumerable circumstances was needed, without any one of which the event could not have taken place. It was necessary that millions of men, in whose hands lay the real power, The soldiers who fired or transported provisions and guns should consent to carry out the will of these weak individuals, and should have been induced to do so by an infinite number of diverse and complex causes. We are forced to fall back on fatalism as an explanation of irrational events, that is to say, the reasonableness of which we do not understand. The more we try to explain such events in history reasonably, the more unreasonable and incomprehensible do they become to us. End quote. I chose to read this question because it is something I think a lot about. As you allude to in your question, Tolstoy is not exactly a neutral observer here. He had his own philosophy, and that philosophy was very skeptical of individuals' ability to influence historical forces. So, naturally, he does overstate the case a bit. However, I do think it's useful to question how much agency historical actors really had. Ever since I started doing this show, and started diving deeper into historical events than I ever had before, I have often found myself struck by how little choice the key players felt they had in the moment. Particularly when it comes to military matters, it's very easy to fall into a simplistic view of things, imagining battles and campaigns as glorified chess matches, with the generals plotting their strategies, then deploying their units like pieces on the board. In fact, if you want to get really meta, the very act of turning history into a narrative tends to favor the idea of individual agency. After all, stories need characters, and in any good story, the characters have an impact on events. No one wants to read something in which the characters are simply bandied about by forces totally outside their control. Just for practical reasons, I often find myself personalizing events, saying, Napoleon did this, when what I really mean is that based on the information they had at the time, Napoleon and his staff decided this was the only logical course of action. However, I will say this, while it's important to keep this critique in mind, we can easily go too far the other direction. If Napoleon really was a puppeteer whose strings were not connected to anything, then he and his government certainly wasted a lot of resources on things like bureaucracy and an army general staff. True, these systems were imperfect, and we, as modern people who live in a society built on such systems, might sometimes overestimate them. But Napoleon was a very intelligent man, as were many of his senior officials. I don't think they would have relied so much on these systems of command and control if they didn't do something. And there's no denying the fact that countries that invested in such systems tended to surpass those that did not. We might ask Tolstoy how, in his time, Russia was able to so consistently outclass its southern rivals, Persia and the Ottoman Empire. Was it the will of God, or some unknowable current of history, or was it because the Russian state was consistently much more effective at investing and directing its resources? I've always thought Karl Marx summed up this tension quite well. Quote, "People make their own history, but they do not make it as they please. They do not make it under self-selected circumstances, but under circumstances existing already, given and transmitted from the past." End quote. So I'm afraid I don't have a very satisfying answer for you, other than to say this is something I think about a lot. When I started the show, part of the idea was to turn the traditional great man history on its head, tell Napoleon's personal story and the stories of other significant figures of this era, but also to use their biographies as an entry point to talk about the big, impersonal historical forces that made them who they were and created the world they lived in. Next, I thought we'd go with a lighter question. David M. asked, "Does it bother you that the first lyric of ABBA's Waterloo is misleading? Ever since becoming a Napoleon head, when I hear it at the grocery store, I want to chime in with a correction. Not exactly. He didn't surrender to British custody for a few weeks." Mostly, I just wanted to read this question because it made me laugh. But in truth, I actually love that there is a famous pop song that talks about Napoleon, and I think if you're seriously interested in Napoleonic history, you should love it too. I've never been an ABBA fan. In fact, personally, I find that song a little annoying. However, I'm always glad to see Napoleon in pop culture. I almost hate to say it, but it's stuff like this that keeps Napoleon in the public consciousness 200 years after his death. In my book, almost anything that gets people talking about Napoleonic history is good. Yes, pop culture depictions of him and the era he helped shape are almost always laughably inaccurate. But that's simply the nature of pop culture. Anything real that gets fed into the content machine winds up warped beyond all recognition. But even inaccurate depictions can spark interest and start conversations. Anyone who really wants to can always dig deeper and find the real story. I'm sure many of you listening would never have become interested in history without a video game, a movie, or a TV show providing that initial spark. I'm sure there are at least a few people out there who heard that ABBA song and went to the library. When I see public discussions about history, I sometimes feel that historians and history enthusiasts can be off-putting. We should be happy and encouraging whenever people want to talk about history. Maybe not so focused on pedantically trying to prove how much more we know about the topic than other people. So, I say, crank up ABBA's Waterloo. Maybe we'll get lucky and Drake will do a song about Austerlitz. I'd like to close out this dispatch with a short reading. Last episode, I mentioned that the famous German writer Heinrich Heine wrote about the French occupation of his country with some nostalgia. Here is one of his poems on the subject, titled The Drum Major. Quote, "The old drum major it is that we see. Poor fellow, he's pulled down, sadly. In the emperor's time, a youngster was he, and merrily lived and gladly. He used to balance his ponderous stick, with a smile on his face played lightly. The silver lace on his tunic so thick, in the rays of the sun gleamed brightly. Whene'er with a mighty roll of the drum he entered a village or city, he caused an echo responsive to come in the hearts of each girl, plain or pretty. He came and saw and conquered too, each fair one welcomed him in. His black mustache was wetted through with the tears of German women. Resistance was in vain in every land that the foreign invaders came to. The emperor vanquished the gentleman and the drum major each maiden and dame too. Our sorrows full long we patiently bore, like oaks with no one to heed 'em, until the authorities gave us once more the signal to battle for freedom. Like buffaloes rushing on to the fray, we tossed our horns up proudly. The yoke of France we cast away, the songs of corner sang loudly. Oh, terrible verses! The tyrant's ear at their awful sound revolted. The emperor and the drum major in fear precipitately bolted. They both of them reaped the wages of sin, and came to an end inglorious. The Emperor Napoleon tumbled in the hands of the Britons victorious. In St. Helena his time now passed, in martyrdom banished from France, sir, and after long suffering died at last of that terrible ailment, cancer. The poor drum major, too, fell in disgrace and lost his situation. In our hotel he took the place of boots, what degradation! He warms the oven, he scours the pots, and wood and water fetches. His gray head wags as he wheezingly trots up the stairs, so weak the poor wretch is. When Fritz comes to see me, he finds himself inclined to jeer and rally, the comical, lanky, poor old elf, and his motions shilly-shally. Oh, Fritz, a truce to raillery, please! The sons of Germany never should fallen greatness love to tease, or torment endeavor. Such people you ought to regard with pride and filial piety rather. Such people you ought to regard with pride and filial piety rather. Perchance, on the mother's side, that old man is your father." End quote. That's all for now. We'll close out with a recording of Waterloo by ABBA. Just kidding. Until next time, thanks for listening.